Hello there, and a very good morning to you. You're very welcome indeed to the programme this morning. We'll start today with the Sunday Independent and a very sad picture of Jonathan Sexton yesterday. I suppose some you win, some you lose, and you can't be winning all the time, but you can kind of go a little bit into mourning. But my mother used to say, pride goes before a fall, and everybody was so sure we were going to win yesterday. But anyway, there you go. Sympathies to all involved. Now, the headline there is Varadkar defends high cost of hospital, and indeed he does, and he goes, he's kind of saying it's not that expensive if you think of it as a cost over 10 years, but I maybe Mr. Varadkar comes from a different school to the rest of us. 2 billion sounds like a lot of money to me, and a lot of money to a lot of other people too. The Sunday Times, and they have a picture of Bundiaki there, their main story, farmers set for huge EU payoff in hard Brexit. Well, I presume if the farmers are going to get something, then small and medium-sized enterprises will be looking for things. God, there's a lot of trouble up ahead. Anyway, their other headline, Children's Hospital spends nearly 1 million on a PR firm. And they also have Cavan Senator racks up 28 trips. Now, the Sunday Business Post, most of, this is a good story, most of the 221 cervical check women are now cancer-free. Now, obviously, as one reads that out, you know that some of them are not, but it is very, very good to know that the majority of them are. And the next story, data protection watchdog questions Google about tracking every place you go. And indeed, we had the data protection person herself in here yesterday, and they're doing a lot of work on a lot of the big names, shall we say. By the way, just looking at the Sunday Telegraph, they have the alternative picture to Jonathan Sexton on their front page, which is a very happy duo who had won. Anyway, and their main headline, May, I'll fight for Britain in Brussels. And the Observer, rebel Labour MP set to quit party and form centre group. And the Irish Mail on Sunday, TD's aide forged papers for 18k pay hike. Now, let me introduce our guest to you this morning with us in studio. Bertie Ahern, former Taoiseach, Dr. Emily O'Connor, President of the Irish Association for Emergency Medicine, Harry McGee, political correspondent of the Irish Times, Ursula Tipp, partner, Tipp McKnight Solicitors and international tax expert, Paul Somerville, market analyst, and Susan Mitchell, health editor and also assistant editor, I think, of the Sunday Business Post, deputy editor, sorry, recently appointed, and congratulations for that. And you've come in just for this section while we go through a couple of health stories. On the resignation yesterday, what was your own take on that?
I think he probably had no choice. I think the level of controversy surrounding the overspend or the increase in construction costs is huge, and it was damaging to the project. On a personal level, I feel sorry for the man because he's invested 6 years of his life. Yes, I'm sure he was paid handsomely for that, but he's invested 6 years at least of his time in this project. But I think it's also worth saying that we still don't have the report into what went wrong. So there may well be
systems
some people...
failure. Lack of communication.
Well, they have said
that, how am I doing? How much is that worth?
But they have said that this report won't actually identify any one individual as being culpable. But I don't think it's going to be difficult to extrapolate, or you'd imagine from the report, well, who did what? Well, there's only a small enough team involved at a very, very senior level in that the National Paediatric Hospital Development Board is charged with bringing this project in, or was charged with bringing
right.
it in. million on budget.
Okay.
And on time. And it's also not on time.
Can I just quote from something in yesterday's Irish Times, and it was Paul Cullen. In 2017, we've talked about the National Paediatric Hospital Development Board, and as you say, they were to bring the project through. In 2017, it was decided to revise these governance arrangements. New layers were created, a Children's Hospital Project and Programme Board, chaired by Secretary General of the Department, a Children's Hospital Project and Programming Steering Group, chaired by the Deputy Director General of the HSE. The steering group reports to the Programme Board, while the Development Board provides updates on progress to the steering group. At that stage, I'm running out the door.
It's a very...
Who makes a decision in that mess?
Well, it's a very messy governance structure. There's no doubt about that. But ultimately, the individual, the accounting officer for the Department of Health is the Secretary General, Jim Breslin, who came under a lot of pressure when he was questioned last week by members of the Public Accounts Committee. He is the accounting officer. Ultimately, they were all reporting into him. So I'd imagine that over the coming weeks, he's going to come under a lot more pressure.
Yeah, and I see writing an article today quoting Noel Smith, who offered us a free site and offered to build it without making a profit all those years ago. And he, again, cannot get over the fact that there was no quantities done, no bill of quantities done. I mean, what they talk about, a remeasurable contract with no design brief and no bill of quantities, like, that sounds like complete and utter madness.
Well, according to people involved in the construction sector, it was a very, very unusual way to go to tender. So they had this two-step tender process. In the initial stage, they just tendered for the basic foundations.
Cleaning up the site.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Decanting buildings on the site, because obviously it was a really congested site, as we all know. So they had to do that. And then they went into stage B. But BAM, I think, was the only, like, BAM tendered, re-tendered again. It was very, very difficult. And this was raised, I think, by Kate O'Connell, Fine Gael TD, during the week. What other company is going to come in and take over from a company that has already started, excuse me, the main contractor that has already started work on the site? And, you know, something that I think really hasn't been addressed yet is BAM's initial tender price, or what it offered to do to build the hospital for, came in at 130 million lower than anybody else's. And that doesn't seem to have raised any red flags, which is surprising. But we still don't know. You know, many people have said, oh, this is the most expensive hospital in the world. Actually, it's not. And that's inaccurate. It's certainly one of the most expensive hospitals in the world. We're up there, but there's one in Sweden that cost 5 billion. And there's a huge controversy over that. But at least it's double the size, or has twice as many beds as our one will. But what I think we still don't know is, we all think 2 billion sounds like an astronomical sum of money. Now, sorry, 1.4 billion is the actual construction cost.
Yeah, but that doesn't include computers.
No, it doesn't. It's 1.7 billion all in at the moment, when you include, you know, electronic health records, etc. But this price, it's highly likely that it's going to rise. And during the week, Jim Breslin, the Secretary General of the department, said he couldn't guarantee that it will come in under 2 billion. So it's a huge amount of money. And again, just going back to what I said about the congested site there, from the outset, people were very critical of the choice of this site. And Bertie will be familiar with all the criticisms back in his time about the Matter location, which was obviously previous to this one and fell through when On Board Planola said it couldn't go ahead. But people said that because the site is so congested, there would be huge increases in construction costs as a result of that, because it was more difficult to access. And we still don't know what the choice of site has added to the bill. So in other words, if we had built the hospital out in Connolly, where there's huge space, it's on the M50, what would it be coming in at? And they haven't been able to address that.
Yeah, well, I think a number of people are wondering, should we cut our losses now? Because the site has been cleared in James, so it could be used for something else. Mm-hmm. The money wouldn't be wasted, and you could possibly do a building that has been designed and priced.
You could, and I heard somebody suggest to me, could you build one of the elective-only hospitals that they're talking about building on the current site at St James's? But this has been, I mean, we've been talking about building a new hospital since the 1990s.
When was it, Bertie Hearn, can you remember?
The late 90s.
Was it?
The late 90s, there's been There was an examination by even before the HSE. The Department of Health were there, and they had looked around. They examined various sites. They looked at what was the best thing to do. The government that I led in 2006, Mary Harney was the minister. She went through an exhaustive period of examining issues about access, the clinical governance, the costs. The decision was made unanimously on recommendation of the HSE and experts from outside the country to put the hospital on the Mater site.
Yeah.
That it ran into the recession times. Then the new government came in, and I think the Minister of Health, and I wish him well because he's having a rough time, and wish himself and his wife well with their new baby. But during the week, he said that what happened then was, if I can quote him correctly, that we got into parish pump politics, trying to put the hospital into people's constituency. He could have been talking about me, but I just remind him that...
I wonder.
Well, I just remind him that James was also my constituency, so though I worked in the Mater in my earlier days. But then what I'd like to remind him is that when the new government came in 2011, they wisely, I suppose, they set up another independent review. The then minister, James O'Reilly, I got in because consultants in Crumlin and James's, who didn't like the Mater site for whatever reason, but I won't go into that, they brought in experts from Colorado, from Australia, from America.
What about a bit of local common sense?
Well, I think they brought in the hospitals as well, but the thing, Marion, I don't want to get into this battle because I had plenty of it years ago.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, our three children's hospitals wouldn't agree. And at the time, and I still hold the same view, I didn't care where the hospital was. To be honest, I don't care. We badly need a children's hospital. The reason the Mater site... was considered because since 1850s or 1860s, Temple Street is beside the Mater. And the experts, local and nationally and international and everything else, they argued that the hospital, whatever hospital, wherever it is, should be beside a general hospital with specialties, should be beside a children's hospital.
I heard Finn Branagh the other morning.
Maternity.
And I mean, he's so well respected. He's put in years with... children and oncology, and he was saying the notion of an adult general hospital is for the birds, and he was talking about a cardiac specialist or surgeon or whatever the term is, and he said they would look at a baby and run 10 miles. Now, they can do stuff for adult hearts, but he was saying they couldn't go near a baby's heart because he said it's the size of a strawberry. How anybody could go near it is beyond me, because it must be very scary indeed. Emily O'Connor, how do you view all this?
Oh, God, my heart sinks when I remember all that Mr. Hearn says has gone on. I think I'm a doctor, and what we desperately want is for this to happen. There hasn't been investment in the infrastructure for children's health in Ireland since, I think, Crumlin was built in the 1950s. And, you know, as both a doctor and a mum, you know, none of us... We've all had experiences of lying on floors beside our sick kids in tiny hospital rooms, etc. And we just want this to happen. I know what Mr. Hearn said about the three children's hospitals, there not being agreement early on. Since January this year, we now have one children's hospital in Dublin across three sites. So hopefully we've gotten over that phase of it. We want this to happen. The thoughts of us starting from scratch somewhere else again fill me with horror.
Except that it might go smoothly.
Or it might not.
Yeah, well, if you've got a site that's a flat greenfield site that has access from Donegal and Kerry and Galway and wherever else you want. Anyway, I know this sounds like a 10-year-old thing. Paul Somerville, can I come to you? As I read out that really clear, distinct description of who decides how many taps you need and how many floor tiles.
It's the comedy programme Yes Minister reminds me of. This also reminds me of Anglo-Irish Bank when they went to the central bank. And what they do is, obviously, you go lowball the number, and once they're in, and you have to keep paying. So this isn't about should we have a children's hospital. Obviously, this decision's already made. We can't move it now. So I understand most people in Ireland would have thought it should be on a greenfield site. Somebody said it wasn't. We're building it now. The problem here is, what is the government are they overseeing this or not? Now, this guy resigned yesterday because of the overruns. He didn't say because of the overruns, actually.
No, he
because
said,
of the commentary
yes,
about the overruns.
Yeah.
Now, Leo Varadkar has come out today and said, well, look, it's not really over budget. And not only that has he come... Like, well, his statement today just doesn't make any sense. He says there'll be no delay to any other projects. So where is this money tree coming from? And his nonchalant response to this is incredible. At the same time as the nurses are going on strike, the same time as Brexit. And I think it's absolutely incredible that our Taoiseach is coming out and saying, look, it doesn't really matter how much it costs. We're just going to build it.
Yeah,
and this is why people are so angry.
Yeah.
Can you not possibly get in people who can build a hospital from around the world and build it to cost and on time? Like Leo Varadkar actually said, unless an asteroid hits Ireland, this hospital will be built in 2020. I mean, and that's not going to happen. You know, but Leo seems to get off the hook quite a bit. I feel very sorry for Simon Harris. I actually think he's doing quite a good job as minister.
But maybe the asteroid landed on the site of St. James's Hospital.
Yeah, that's why there's a big hole there.
Maybe the asteroid landed on the site of St. James's Hospital.
Well, we had one landing in Cuba. In fairness, we had an asteroid this week. One
right.
landed in Cuba, and that was in the papers.
Right.
But nobody got hit there. But yes, I fully agree. We should get on with building the hospital. That's, I think, the big problem now. You know, the way that we're now wanting maybe to have reports about who's to blame and all that. That's not going to get it built. And yes, maybe if it's too complicated to build it there, let's put it somewhere else, but get it built, get on with
just
the job.
That's insult to injury.
Do you know the way
PwC another 450
Yeah, they're only fighting. All this in-house fighting will only delay the process further, and I think they should get on with putting the bricks and mortar together and get the kids into the beds.
And Harry, I'm going to that piece where Leo Varadkar said this morning that it wasn't going to affect any other capital investment, given that we need major trauma centres built, given that we need new emergency departments built, so I'm going to cut out that bit and stick it on my wall to remind him that
To remind him that
when he said the building of the children's hospital wouldn't affect
the
other.
We need an extra, an additional 100 million at least every year. Where is that money going to come from? And the capital budget in health has been woefully low and inadequate over the past 10 years. And it's not just new construction or new buildings. It's new equipment. It's ambulances that need to be replaced. It's x-ray machines, CT scanners, etc. that we're in dire need of. So it will have an impact on other projects.
I mean, his comments to The Independent this morning were extraordinarily blasé and reminded me of unfortunate comments that Noel Dempsey made years ago when he kind of discounted the importance of millions of euro. And there's nothing that angers the voter or the taxpayer than the notion of public money being wasted in such a flagrant way. We had an estimate, a tender estimate of 983 million euro only in February of 2017. That's already gone up to 1.433 billion. And as we have heard, Susan was adverting to the Public Accounts Committee meeting on Tuesday, Jim Breslin admitting the cost may go over 2 billion. Now, there have been some extras. The Grenfell Towers, for example, new safety procedures would have added to the cost.
Yeah, but put something to you, Harry? If you're going to put children into a hospital, small babies, etc., etc., would you not have pre-planned to have the state-of-the-art fire prevention?
Yes, of course you should have.
So why does it come in as an extra?
Well, that's a very good question.
It and shouldn't it's one be an of, extra because it's a building regulation as well. You know, it's a legal requirement.
I
find that jaw-dropping. I really do. That you think after the event you're going to put children, never mind the doctors or the nurses, in there without absolute
safety. Well, maybe some of the issues that arose in Grenfell had not been foreseeable beforehand. I'm not a technical expert in any way, but I mean that was something that was a cost accumulator.
I would suggest that the cost of the IT systems are going to go through the roof also. If you see the experience in the UK, I mean, they spent over 10 billion on their IT systems and then after 10 years it didn't work at all. So I would suggest...
Thanks for that, Paul.
The IT system alone budget is going to be way higher.
But the point that Susan raised about the tender, BAM put in a tender that was 130 million euro less than anybody else, 670 million, which bears absolutely no relation to the outturn that we're seeing at the moment. And apparently that's not the first instance of that in Irish capital projects. And if that practice is recurring again and again, it's something that really needs to be addressed and really
needs
to be
looked at. When we started doing the roads, we were overrunning on time, overrunning on money, hemorrhaging money. And then that stopped. How did that stop?
Well, there were a number of things. We set up the National Transport Authority and the NRA, and we started doing projects of sufficient scale. The old system was a county council did their bit. So Kildare did their bit, Laois did their bit, Carlow did their bit, whatever road we were on. When we did the main road, when we did Dublin, Belfast, Galway, Cork, Limerick, they were done in blocks. They were it was organised, and that's brought in sufficiently big contractors. Need I say a lot of international contractors? And because they were used of doing and costing very big projects, they were able to scale it far better. And then we went through a series of projects where we'd know they were all in on time, except there was one or two exceptional things. I think there was one part of the road where people didn't realise it was over a bog, but you know, there were very clear reasons. But all of the other ones were coming in on time. And you know, we did, I was saying earlier on to our colleagues that one of the things we did at that time was to stop. We brought in the Spanish and got advice from the Spanish, because they at the time were getting huge EU funds. They were doing massive roadways, massive infrastructure projects, and they gave us a lot of advice. And I chaired the Infrastructural Cabinet Committee for 11 years every Thursday, and you know, we were bringing in outside experts, and we didn't, I'd like to say we all did it out of our own thing, but we did because we took advice from abroad,
right,
from people who were doing sufficiently large projects.
Yeah. I mean, but one of the things that you can hazard a guess at is, given that there is nobody that I can ascertain there that can say, no, we're not going to do that. We live without that. We look at it later. So, I mean, it was suggested to me by somebody else that you can have architects, mea culpa in a former life, going around and saying, do you know what, we'll knock that down and we'll do whatever there and open up that space and we could do it. And every time you do that and you have a change, it's going to cost money. And you have to have somebody that says, no, we're not doing it.
But that was what these individuals, Bertie's talking there about bringing in people from outside or external experts. John Pollock, who is a project manager, and Tom Costello were those outside experts. Tom Costello was a former managing director of CISC. So that was the whole purpose of bringing these individuals in.
Okay. Listen, we leave that there for a moment because I'm watching the clock and we've a whole heap of stuff to get through. That's very nice news about cervical check.
It is.
Now, I'm conscious that it's not 100% and that there are worried people still.
Exactly. I think up until now, we had no idea with regard to the 221 cervical check women affected, how many of them were still seriously ill. And we've obviously seen tragic cases in recent times, such as Emma Vicfahuna, and then more recently Orla Church in recent weeks, who have passed away. We did not know exactly what the health status of the women involved were. So the HSC did an exercise to try and extract that information from individual doctors around the country. And what they found was that at least 75% of the women affected are cancer-free. Now, obviously, 21 women are dead. There are 14 women who are still in active treatment. But broadly speaking, it is good news. This is better than many people, I think, would have feared. And partly this is because many of them were diagnosed at a very early stage. The vast majority were diagnosed at stage one cancer. But the figures, it also shows that the figures at the outset of this, and there was a rush to get the data, there was huge pressure on the health service to get and produce data. The data was all over the shop originally. There are women counted in that 221 group who didn't even have cervical cancer. They had ovarian cancers or endometrial cancers, and cervical screening doesn't screen for those cancers. So why they were ever included in the original look back audit that was initiated by Cervical Check is hard to fathom.
Right.
There are also about 9 women who didn't have cancer, they had pre-cancer. So it definitely gives us a much better picture of where we're at.
Well, that pre-cancer is what is the purpose of the exercise, really, isn't it?
Exactly. So this is what cervical screening is designed to try to detect. So they are good news stories.
Okay, and then finally on health, and then we'll move on. The nurses.
Right, yes. So they're obviously the nurses announced yesterday further days of strike action. So they're definitely ramping up their strike activity. There appears to be no meeting of minds at all. Both sides are miles apart, apparently, or they certainly
Brexit.
Were.
Yeah,
exactly. So the nurses are adamant that they need to see an increase in their base pay. The government are saying that it simply cannot do that because it would collapse the public service pay agreement. Other unions have already said that they would look for similar increases if the INMO or nurses, and indeed the Psychiatric Nurses Association as well, if they're successful. So it's difficult to see where there might be a breakthrough. Now, the minister or the government has been suggesting that it would like to do a review of the role of nurses, but I'm not sure that will satisfy nurses who are striking all over the country. They clearly feel extremely strongly about this.
Bertie Ahern, you were supposed to be the master of this. Do you just pay up?
No, I don't think the Minister of Finance can or will do that. Like, from his point of view, and I was in that seat long enough, but he's a deal to 2020. The nurses signed up to that deal. There is a pot of money of 1.1 billion, which is a lot of money within that, which can be used for trying to deal with things. And I presume whatever leeway there is has to be within that. If he was to move outside of it and give a 12% increase to nurses, which is effectively what it boils down to, as I understand it, 300 million, the knock-on claims will be massive. And this was the reason a decade ago we tried to move away from the old system of knock-ons in the public service and have public service reviews. The first one of those we had, public servants got good increases, and there was an uproar about that. The second one, nobody wants to remember because public servants got nothing. But once we moved away from that system, you're now stuck with a system where the minister finds that it's not 300 million for the nurses, it's the knock on. The only thing is, you know, 2020 isn't an awful long time away. And I'm sure he's thinking in the review that if that gets him up to the other side of that, then he can start looking again.
Okay.
But he is faced, and I think, you know, I think the nurses have huge public support. I have a lot of sympathy with nurses. I think they do leave the country very fast after they qualify. That's a pity. And they work hard. I don't think there's anything about that. But I don't think a Minister of Finance can just sign up for a 12% increase within a pay review period and say, you know, here's another 700 or 800 million. I don't think that's very easy for him to do that.
You wanted to come in there.
Yeah, so...
Sorry, Emily O'Connor.
That's
yeah.
Okay. So I just think all sides in this negotiation, they need to be aware of the impact of how critical nurses are in the health sector, so that both sides know that this is going to be a struggle and the impact it's going to have on patients. I suppose when as a doctor who works in an emergency department, we're the part of the system where patients are going to come when other parts of the system start struggling. So if your public health nurse doesn't arrive and you need something done, you're going to come in. If you've been maybe struggling on a waiting list, waiting for your appointment, and it gets cancelled again, you're going to come to the ED. And we don't want patients in EDs or nurses and doctors in EDs to become the battleground for this strike. We work with fantastic nurses in EDs, and I saw them struggle last week to try and deliver a certain amount of care in face of the strike, and it's a struggle every time. The concern is that not only are general numbers in emergency departments reducing, so the numbers of nurses we're getting, but also the critical role of what we call the triage nurse, who is the person in the department who decides what's life-threatening or limb-threatening. Now, that role was withdrawn from emergency departments all around the country last week. I say not my own, thank you very much to those people who made it happen. But that meant that critical prioritisation didn't happen. So on last Wednesday, senior doctors stepped into that breach, and there is a form of, it's not the same, but it's a form of prioritisation that we can do, and we made it through that 24 hours. That's not sustainable on an ongoing basis. There aren't consultants on site in EDs 24/7 anywhere in the country.
Can I ask you a question? When procedures are cancelled, I understand we call everything a procedure now rather than an operation, but anyway, and 25,000 of them were cancelled. What happens to the staff who are assigned to that?
I think that's a really good question. I think many of them, you mean the nursing staff or the medical staff?
And both.
Both. I suppose the nursing strike, if they're members of the INMO, are out on strike.
On strike, yeah.
The medical staff, it definitely didn't include me because we were swamped.
No,
I'm not too sure
about
the other medical staff. Yeah.
For, I don't know, a hip operation or some standard kind of thing that people get done. So the guy or the woman that was doing that, are they twiddling their thumbs then?
I remember back to the 1999 nurses dispute, and definitely at that stage, doctors in the system that were engaged in elective activity that was cancelled did end up with less to do. I don't know what's happening currently. I'm not aware of any plans to redirect those staff. But, you know, that's definitely not going to be the case in emergency departments because we're going to be struggling.
But I do remember Maurice Nelligan saying that he was climbing up the walls, God rest his soul now, that he would come in and he would have prep patients and all of that. And he said he could twiddle his thumbs or go out and play golf, was what he said. And it wasn't that he wanted to play golf, he was just completely infuriated.
Believe me, Marion, the health service, we do not need anybody to be out playing golf
so
or twiddling their thumbs.
So what do you do if something is cancelled?
I think that's a question you need to direct at the HSE. I really don't know. Yeah, go, Susan.
Well, I've certainly spoken to lots of surgeons in particular who have said, and I don't want to use the quote, twiddling their thumbs, perhaps they're reading research or I don't know what they're doing, but who have said that they are unable to work the hours that they would like to work, even outside of the strike action, because they can't get into operating theatres. There aren't enough theatre nurses, for example, to actually allow them to do their job. So they themselves have said that they're not able to do the procedures or operations that they would like to do. So I can only imagine that when things grind to a halt on strike days, that the same is happening again.
And I know Michael, I quote him a lot. Michael O'Keefe has been on the programme and he said he gets twice the work done in half the time in the private sector that he does in the public sector. He repeats it and repeats it and repeats it.
I'll have to answer that as well, if I can. You know, so your apples and oranges, different patient cohorts between private and public. But yes, you are right. A doctor working in the private health sector gets all the ancillary work done for them to maximise their clinical skills. In the public health sector, you have to do the clinical piece along with all the other pieces. So there is a difference, but there's also a different group of patients in both sectors.
Yeah. So what does that mean?
So it means that the sickest, the most vulnerable, the most complex are in the public sector.
All right, OK. Ursula?
Yeah, I just want to say I do not like if patients are compared with apples and oranges or something because, you know, the way I do think they're all human beings and they all have their needs. Yeah. And one thing which I'm missing a little bit from the discussion so far is just that, yes, it's about the pay of the nurses, but I think we also have to look that there are structural problems because I do think, you know, the way I think the nurses would probably be okay with saying, okay, we wait for our pay increase or something until that agreement because, yes, we signed up to it, if the conditions they were working under were okay. And I think that's the big problem. I think the conditions they are working under, they are not okay. They are not enough nurses. There's total overcrowding. And I think there's so many positions which are not filled.
Right.
And that, I think, we have to get away from just looking at the pay.
Okay. Paul, should Pascal Donoghue pay up?
Well, unfortunately, he won't be able to. But there's a wider problem here because we need to talk about how the economy is run. Because basically what is happening here is, by international standards, nurses get quite well paid. Now, they're not as well paid as, say, Australia, and they keep comparing themselves to Australians. But Australia's going through a huge boom because China has printed so much money, $4.5 trillion, and it's going into the Australian economy. The Australian economy is slowing down. So I think in 2 years' time, that argument will be null and void. But our problem here is the cost of living in Ireland is so high. So these nurses can't, you know, it's the same with the Gardaí, same with everyone. They can't afford to rent properties. And the reason our housing market is so bastardised and corrupted is because of the decisions we made after the financial crisis. I would say we've run our economy extremely poorly since 2008. And these are the problems. So giving the nurses a pay increase isn't going to solve anything. One thing I would like to say is, OK, well, if the nurses want 300 million, they need to go and to the budget of 16 billion and say, where can we cut 300 million out of this budget? I'd like to see nurses come up with ideas about where there's waste in the system. So I think it's a wider question, but obviously I have sympathy with the nurses on a local scale, but Pascal O'Donoghue, there is no chance that he can just go and give them the pay increase. So I would suggest he's going to try and do a review till 2020.
This is a political nightmare, I would have thought.
It is, yeah. The government have been able to avail of a report that was done by the Public Services Pay Commission last year, which said, and the nurses have framed the dispute in this way, they've said that the recruitment crisis is directly related to pay. Mm-hmm. And the Public Services Pay Commission differed from that. And it did say that pay was a factor, but it said it wasn't the overriding factor. And it specified three things: location allowances, specialised qualification allowances, and also when a nurse qualifies, it takes 20 years for a nurse to go from being a staff nurse to being to get
there's
senior position.
There's space to move in.
Yeah,
there.
They could. Yeah. They offered a package that was worth 20 million. Now that has been rejected by the nurses. Now they have a biddable argument. I mean, nursing nowadays is a degree qualification. And the argument of the nurses' unions is that
they want the same as
29,000. Other professionals are going in at 36,000. I think there is scope for an independent review. But as the Taoiseach, as Bertie Ahern was saying there, the former Taoiseach was saying, 300 million. If that claim were to be allowed, there'll also be the notion of equivalence. And at the moment, the government, its policies just won't allow it.
Okay. Just one point, Marion.
Yes.
After yesterday's meeting, the executives of the nurses, there's 7 days now, if I count right, between now and the end of February for strike action. Every dispute comes to an end, and I think it would be best if the sides sit down and have meaningful discussions now, because 7 days of disputes, you know, you're talking about 150,000 cancellation of procedures this month. So I think whatever they can do, or whatever way they can box it off in a sensible way, they're better off having the discussions sooner rather than later, because I think to drag it out into March or something, we will just create havoc for the health service.
Right.
And every single one of those days is going to be very difficult in the emergency departments.
Just to go back actually to Harry's point there about pay parity, and I think most of us, or many people, would feel, yes, nursing is a graduate degree course, that there should be pay parity. The counter-argument to that is that most nurses, or many nurses, would not have the same level of clinical autonomy as physiotherapists, etc., with whom they're looking for pay parity.
Right.
And also, there is a fundamental problem with the role of nursing in Ireland. They are not able, or many of them are not able, to do very simple tasks that are routinely done by nurses overseas without doing additional training. And that's something that we do need to examine as well, and skill mix in the health service. The likes of theatre assistants, physician assistants, that are widely used in other jurisdictions and that have been that simply have not been allowed into the health service here.
Because the unions didn't want them.
Because the unions don't want them.
Okay, listen, we'll leave it there. I didn't think we'd spend that much time on health. Just going back to the Children's Hospital, spokesperson for the Taoiseach contacted the show to say, in relation to the Children's Hospital overrun, what the Taoiseach says was that other projects would not be cancelled. And he went on in the Sunday Independent article to say that some projects might be deferred by weeks or months. And on that note, we'll take a break. Welcome back to the programme. Well, now that's something, isn't it? 42 minutes and we didn't mention Brexit, I think, once. But we're certainly going to have to. And if you'll go through the papers today, Theresa May herself is writing in The Telegraph, "I'm going to battle for Britain." We have the Business Post, "Leo's big gamble." Sunday Times, "Give and take can get Brexit deal over the line." That's the Conor Brady article. Sindo, "Ministers warn Brexit will wipe out the meat sector." And on and on and on and on. And there is talk of give and take. And as I said, that's what Conor Brady was on about. And Owen Harris was saying, let's go for a soft border and cut a bit of slack for Mrs. May. Can I ask you, before we get into the detail of this, because you historically you were right in there, Bertie Ahern, and when the Queen came here and when our President went over, it looked, and your relationship also with Tony Blair, it looked like relations between Dublin and London and the old enemy, so to speak, and here, were at an all-time high, and that we were going into the future on a very positive note. Is that all slipping irrevocably away? Because we have to think long term as well. What will it be like 10 years from now or 15 years from now?
Yeah, I'm afraid it is slipping for now. People regularly ask me the question, you know, on the other side of this, how hard is it going to be to patch it all up again? And it's no point getting into the blame game, but I'm afraid, you know, Brexit has made changes for us in the last 2.5 years has been very difficult. And, you know, a lot of the remarks made, maybe on all sides, but I think a lot of the remarks made in the House of Commons last year, they didn't help it. And I think a lot of the criticism of us, the Irish, you know, is gaining ground again in the UK. And I think that's a pity. Now, there are a number of reasons for it. I think, one, the institutions not being up in the north didn't give the vehicle that would have been there. I think if things had been trashed out within the executive and the assembly, in my view, it would have been far, far better. That's number one. The second bit was the relationships between the parties in the north, including the DUP, and ourselves in the south through the north-south bodies, that would have been better. And number three, the relationship between east-west, which was the third part of Good Friday, between ourselves and our friends in Westminster, number 10, that would have been far better. In the absence of that, and no other vehicle, and the fact that there were, I think, only two meetings in the last 7 or 8 years of the institutions of North South between the two governments, that hasn't helped. So I'm afraid it's a bad situation. And if you notice last Tuesday night, which unfortunately I'm stuck into following this and blow by blow, the amount of reference and the way it all played out last Tuesday was that the backstop is the only cause.
Yeah.
And the votes were about the backstop. Now, we know that's not true, but, you know, that was the presentation of last Tuesday night.
But it is the belief now, isn't it?
It is the belief, and it is the big issue. And you made reference to Theresa May's article this morning in the Telegraph.
Yes.
That line after line, she's coming back to the backstop. And she now believes that she has clarified what is the issue, and that this gives her the mandate to go back to Brussels and talk about the issue. Like in everything, you have to try and work to find a solution. And I suppose Owen Harris this morning, he's been standing out giving an alternative view for several weeks.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the end, you're going to have to try to negotiate something. And you know, Simon Coveney, who I think has done a good job in this, and I think he has fought our case. I don't think he's been trying to be over emotive about it. He wants to find a solution to it. And I think we're now going to have to try and find a solution. The only thing where I disagree with some people, I think it's not fair for us to say, or for the EU, for that matter, to say nothing has changed. I mean, there was a vote in the House of Commons and the Prime Minister of the day lost by 230. Now, if you kind of lost a vote by 230 in most democracies, you know what would happen. So you can't say nothing has changed. So I think we have to say there's a different, we're on a different pitch. That does not say that we have to throw out the backstop. I mean, in my view, and Simon Coveney has said this, and the Taoiseach has said this, that the future relationship, and I've explained this simply without complicating, but in the future relationship, we have to work out an alternative to the backstop. We have to, and if we do, the backstop becomes irrelevant.
Or change the language.
Yes, in my view, if that's what has to happen in the long term, because the British have a point, they don't want to be stuck with the whole thing indefinitely. So it seems to me, and Simon has said this, that the solution is to try and bring that forward and find out in the future relationship what is the alternative to backstop.
Well, funnily enough,
and she kind of hints at that too, I think.
Yeah,
today.
She says in her article today she doesn't want to rip up the Good Friday Agreement. And she said the EU has already accepted the principle of, in inverted commas, alternative arrangements superseding the backstop. I didn't know that.
Well, what they have said is, in the alternative arrangements in the future relationship was to find a solution that would make the backstop redundant, and
yeah,
then there's no time limit on the backstop. The They say the Theresa May and others have been saying put a time limit on the backstop. Well, the Irish government correctly say you cannot put a time limit on it. But what you can do, you can try to work out in the future relationship what it is in the future relationship that would make it redundant and try and bring that forward. It is the only bit of negotiation wriggle room that I can see.
Right. Okay, Harry, what do you
mean? Yeah, that's a question of sequencing, but the difficulty is that the withdrawal agreement is a legal document and you can't start negotiating future arrangements before, you know, before the backstop has been agreed. So the problem, the difficulty the British have is that it's been agreed and they don't want it, but you can't start negotiating future relationships, you know, before the backstop is agreed. So there's a problem with sequencing. But they can get over that. They've got over worse things before in relation to the Good Friday Agreement. I had thought, there was an editor of a Sunday newspaper years ago who was a very stubborn gentleman and not the brightest. And his very canny news editor used to go in with him. He'd want a story to be the main story on the Sunday. So he knew that he'd always reject something out of hand. So he'd go in first with an outrageous story and the editor would reject it. Then he'd go in with a slightly less outrageous story, the editor would reject it. And on the third pass, he'd go in with the story that he wanted and then the editor would accept
and then
that story.
Deal, yeah.
So I thought that perhaps that was Theresa May's strategy, that she was going to go with something, get it through and then find out it doesn't work and then come back at the end with a more moderate solution that everybody would be happy with. Until I read the Sunday Telegraph this morning. And she has brought to the Sunday Telegraph this morning the kind of resoluteness that the British or the English rugby team brought to the Aviva Stadium yesterday. And I was actually quite surprised at how hard the language was in relation to the insistence on a backstop. And the other thing that I thought was very significant was the fact that she says, although Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party, didn't vote with us, he also believes the potential indefinite nature of the backstop is an issue that needs to be addressed with Brussels. So she's saying that Westminster, the House of Commons, the British Parliament is at one, that the backstop needs to be negotiated. Now, you talk about Conor Brady and Owen Harris's articles this morning, talking about pliability. Conor Brady's was based on the British changing its red lines. And to me, it doesn't seem that at this moment in time, the British is minded to change any of its red lines.
Okay, can I come to you, Paul? You think that in some ways Brexit is sucking the air out of all of our thinking and that there are other things happening in the world that will have a profound effect on us, economically as well as politically.
Yeah, well, first of all, on Brexit, I mean, we're definitely coming to the mass hysteria stage. You know, the headline in the Sunday Times in Britain today is Brexit plan to evacuate the Queen. Then they're talking about the no deal riots. That's the front page. Kentucky Fried Chicken this week said, you know, there's going to be no chicken. That's a huge deal for the UK. So we are absolutely at the mass hysteria stage. And I don't think Ireland needs to do much. I think we just need to keep quiet because we won't be changing the backstop of any description. So we need to let it play out in the British Parliament. Now, I would suggest our best outcome is for Britain to stay in the customs union and the single market. That's what we would like, but we can't really say it, but that's what we would like. Now, the way that is probably going to happen is Theresa May, someone has to get rid of Theresa May. So when she comes back empty-handed from the EU, there's going to be more problems. But there seems to be a fairly decent majority across parties that want to stay in the customs union in the British Parliament. So I would suggest that we just need to stick to our ground. I think Simon Coveney's doing an absolutely excellent job. There's not a lot else we can do, but we need to calm down on the hysteria because there is nothing we can do. It's all in her court. And unfortunately for Britain, they've played their cards so badly, it's incredible. Not to have to agree to the divorce talk and not the future relationship was one of the biggest mistakes of all time. They should be actually negotiating what's the future relationship, not the divorce.
Yeah, but, well, Europe wouldn't go into those.
But to get back to your point, yeah, which is,
Sterling hasn't collapsed.
Well, the financial markets are taking it extremely quietly. So, you know, I was reading last week that Sterling collapsed on this vote. Sterling hasn't collapsed at all. It collapsed, you know, on the original vote. Sterling is up in the last 2 weeks. Sterling is up in 2019, and we're up about 8% since the lows of 2017. The financial markets believe there's going to be something that at the last minute will happen, so there will not be a no deal. But the main point of what you asked me before was we are focused on the UK, and rightly so, for our farmers and everything else. The Italian economy just went into recession this week. The Germans have just lowered their GDP forecasts hugely. Now, the ECB is at negative interest rates at the moment, and we've already printed €4.5 trillion, 40% of EU GDP. That's what we've printed to keep the economies going. And economies are going into recession. This is a huge warning sign for the whole of Europe. American economy is slowing down markedly. The Chinese are in big trouble. And as I referred to earlier, Australia. So you've got the whole world economy is slowing down here. You know, the stock markets around the world had their worst December since 1931. Now, we've recovered in January largely to do with the Fed. But if we're just concentrating on Brexit, we're going to have a big problem, because I think the European economy is in dire situation. And the Italian situation is going to get
worrying.
Is extremely worrying. We've got 40% youth unemployment in Italy. You know, we're talking about populism before. I would say, you know, the next vote in Italy is going to be even more extreme. And I'd say, you know, the European elections in May are going to be extremely
interesting. Ursula, can I come in to you on that?
Yes, can I just say one thing to Theresa May's article? You know, I'm going to battle for Britain in Brussels. That's what Theresa May is saying. I would tell her, but Theresa, the war is over. That's what I would tell her. The big problem on this is that, yes, that type of article would have been fine 18 months ago to write something like that. But you know the way now, at this very, very late stage, less than 2 months before D-Day, to now come up with all these fantastic ideas where, on one side, we have already a legally agreed offer from the 27 EU countries.
Which was rejected by 230.
Oh, I know that, but you know the way, and now, yeah, but it means she either takes it or she doesn't take it, you know, so this idea that you can now unravel that is, I think, a very bad idea. Then on the backstop, yes, I agree, of course, alternative arrangements or something could be thought about, but it should have, in a way, happened in the last 2 years.
Use that dreadful phrase, where we are.
Yes, we are. Where we are, of course, and that's why I like Simon Coveney's article when he says Britain created the Brexit crisis, they must take the initiative. So yes, fine, but I do think for the moment what they're doing is not taking the initiative, it's just trying to protect their own
the amount of time that's going into this. I mean, if you're talking about us having a single pot of money, we only have a single pot of politician time, civil service time, and the amount of hours and money that's going into us talking about Brexit at the moment. Are we going to turn around in 5 or 10 years? And I know Brexit's important, but are we going to turn around and say all this other stuff that we should have been putting our energies into, we missed?
Oh yeah, probably yes. And that's why I like what was previously said, that we have problems.
By Paul,
because we have a lot of problems in other countries. And I agree. For example, Germany, yes, output has already slowed down. The Germans are currently very worried about the trade relationships, let's say the Americans with China, that, you know, the nuclear agreements they've withdrawn, that there's new sort of Cold War scenarios with Russia possible. So there's a lot of big international topics, and of course they're not totally on the agenda, certainly not here. When you read the papers, I was reading the German papers today, and in fairness there they were on the agenda. Brexit was only mentioned once in a financial topic, but otherwise it was Venezuela. There were other topics. There was the US,
interesting,
China.
To see, the head of our central bank is tipped now to get the job as the chief economist in the ECB. I think that's an absolute hospital pass of a job, but I wish him very well. But, you know, so he is going to have his hands full on what next. For an example, the ECB has thrown absolutely everything at the European economy and we're going into recession in Italy, can you just imagine if the US slows down and China slows down, which looks very, very likely? I would suggest the US economy is probably going to be near recession by the end of this year. And we are going to be right at the forefront of it. I'm not sure if we're going to...
What does that mean?
Well, because... our tax, you know, we go back to tax, but, you know, a lot of our taxes are coming in from Google, Amazon. They have all been making serious amounts of money because there's been a bubble created in the stock market around the world because of quantitative easing. Now, quantitative tightening takes that away, so suddenly our tax take will fall. You know, and again, you know, right. Dan O'Brien is writing about that today. I'm not sure if we get a chance, but if we can, we will.
That's about the OECD proposals.
Yeah, but it's also about the nurses' strike. It's about everything, because when you look at, say, take Google for an example, you know, if Google was paying what I would consider the correct amount of tax in 2017, that would have been about 1.8 billion. If they were paying the correct amount of tax in 2016, it would have been about 1.1 billion. They paid about 170 and 160 million. Now, in my view, that has to be looked at.
Okay, we'll have a look at that after the 12 o'clock junction. Just before I take a break, the INMO have been on to say that during the nurses' strike, the INMO have teams ready who are available if called to provide triage on an emergency basis. And thank you very much indeed for that. Now, as you know, we've been talking about it all along, another week of fervent political activity here, the UK and Brussels, but it is alleged case of much heat but no light. Well, one institution helping Ireland prepare for breakfast, good, bad or indifferent, is the European Investment Bank, and its vice president is Andrew MacDool, and he's just joined us in studio. He was also in another incarnation advisor to the former Taoiseach Enda Kenny. You're very welcome indeed to the programme, Andrew.
Thank you, ma'am.
Just ask you a question first of all that has nothing to do with this? You came home yesterday because you wanted to bring your son to the rugby match.
Yes, we flew in Friday evening. I brought my 10-year-old son Leon to the rugby yesterday, who's Ireland's biggest rugby fan, so he was there. But you know what's interesting? It's the first time he's ever seen Ireland lose. I've brought him to a lot of Ireland rugby matches.
Right.
I think by the time I was 10... I'd never seen Ireland win. So it was a good life lesson for him, that
is. Okay. I just thought, you know, that excitement of coming home for a big event, guaranteed to win, not so good.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get back to what's in it. Remind us again of who, what, where, why and how is the EIB?
Well, the EIB is the European Investment Bank. It's the EU bank, so public bank owned by the member states, the still 28 member states of the European Union, and set up under the Treaty of Rome. So we celebrated our 60th anniversary last year. And the purpose of the bank is not to make a profit, unlike commercial banks, but rather to finance projects that deliver on the policy objectives of the European Union and the member states. So a lot of our projects are in relation to infrastructure, climate action, protecting the environment, supporting SMEs and jobs. Supporting
and are you lending the money to governments?
Both. We lend to both governments and indeed to private sector promoters of projects. So.
And what are your rates of interest?
Well, it all depends on the project. And so we do have to earn a return. We do have to get our money back. So it's not a charity and we don't provide grant aid. But we do provide much lower interest rates than private sector financiers.
Say like?
Well, than any of the private sector banks, because, I mean, we fund 1% on the markets.
2%?
Well, when we're lending to governments, who are obviously the most creditworthy risks we can take, we certainly hope, but that's our analysis. When we lend to the member states themselves, we're lending to creditworthy governments and there's no possibility of default. So we're able to basically lend to them at what we fund on the markets, which is often less than 1%. If we're lending to very high-risk corporate innovation projects with no collateral and no security, obviously the interest rates are going to be higher and the terms are going to be shorter. So it all depends on the project. But the key point is we're not trying to make a profit. What we're trying to do is support projects that deliver on important policy objectives. And that distinguishes us from the private
Italy?
Sector.
Pardon?
What about Italy? What's your interest rate for Italy, for an example?
Well, I mean, it depends on the term, obviously, of the loan. But obviously, you know, the 10-year bond in Italy is about 3% at the moment. We will lend for slightly less than that for public sector Italian projects. We've got a 60 billion Italian portfolio. So we're watching, obviously, the economic developments in Italy very, very, very closely. But obviously, we continue to support the Italian economy because what we lend for is always investment. So we're not lending to governments to finance just their budget shortfalls or their deficits. What we're lending for is investment projects that support economic growth.
Is it one of the assessments you have to make, is it, that say, if you look at a country like Italy, that it's too big to fail? Like we weren't, in a sense, and Greece wasn't. I mean, we took a terrible hiding and so did Greece. But I mean, Italy's a very big country.
It's a very big country, but with a very large level of debt, and that's clearly recognised. But it's a founding member of obviously the European Union and of Economic and Monetary Union, and the way we price our loans and the way we analyse the situation is that is not going to change, and therefore When we lend to Italy, it's a safe bet. And so we'll continue to support good Italian projects. I mean, the challenge facing the Italian economy is that there's been effectively no productivity growth in the Italian economy for 18 years. So in fact, rather than cutting back in those type of investments, we need to finance more of those type of investments that actually lead to growth in living standards in Italy.
Let's come back to this parish now, because but I just think of that lurking in the background. We're so consumed with Brexit, we're kind of not watching the rest of Europe in the way we might have at another stage. So what have you done to date, and what is your plan from here on in terms of Brexit, essentially?
Well, I mean, at the request of the Irish government, we've been asked to put in place supports, if you like, soft loan supports for farmers and SMEs that may be affected by Brexit.
A soft loan?
Well, a soft loan is basically a loan on terms and conditions not available from the commercial banks here.
Right.
And we have approved at the EIB as the EU bank, and this is an EU institution, so we've also been asked to do this by the European Commission and the Irish government as evidence of European solidarity for Ireland and recognition that by far and away Ireland is the most exposed economy to the downside risks of Brexit. We were asked to put in place a package of measures to work with the Strategic Banking Corporation of Ireland, which is the Irish National Promotional Institution, to put in place measures that make sure access to finance is not going to be an issue for Irish farmers and SMEs. So, for example, you can imagine how farmers already have been impacted by the change in the exchange rate since 2016. So the exchange rate went from about 80 sterling to the euro to 88, 89, whatever it is in the last few weeks. That had an impact, particularly at the end of 2016 and 2017. So we put in place a working capital scheme that allowed farmers to borrow without collateral for up to 3 years at less than 3%, you know, which was a rate not available from the commercial banks for working capital.
Yeah, but can I ask you, just to understand it, you put loans in, make them available for somebody that's in difficulty because of exchange rates. Like, how did they pay them back? It's not for productivity, is it? It's kind of to hold your hand?
Well, initially it was working capital to see farmers through a difficult set of price changes for their goods. We do it through the commercial banks. So when you borrow, you know, when these EIB loans come through, it's through the commercial banks and the Strategic Banking Corporation of Ireland. So we're not engaging directly with individual farmers. What we're doing is basically providing a guarantee through the Strategic Banking Corporation to the commercial banks that when they lend to farmers or indeed other SMEs that may be affected by Brexit, we'll take a large guarantee against some of the losses. It makes it much more attractive for the banks to do those loans because they're protected against a large part of the losses, and that way they can get the interest rates down and the collateral requirements down.
Right.
So initially it's working capital, so it's a short-term kind of support. But what we want to do now is to support the announcement made by the government in the October budget for what's called a future loan growth scheme. And that is a much longer term lending operation for 8 to 10 years for SMEs and slightly larger businesses that are now looking at investments, say, in new products, new services, new markets that cut their exposure to the UK, that essentially provide them with a way out of their existing dependence on the UK markets. Mm-hmm. So that is the type of longer-term investment that'll increase their competitiveness, their productivity in new markets, new products.
Right.
Classic example would be an Irish, you know, dairy processor that makes cheddar, you know, for the UK market. How are they going to get into other markets?
How are they going to make
the
brie?
Continentals don't love cheddar.
Say we don't like cheddar so much on the continent. May I say that? I know it's not the cheese we would eat there.
Yeah. So that's it. So we're looking
cheddar
at
cheddar manufacturers.
We're looking at Irish firms now looking to make mozzarella.
Yeah.
For example.
Sure, isn't there one down in West Cork?
Yeah,
oh,
there
he
is
makes
already.
Lovely mozzarella. I love that one.
So that's the general idea.
Right.
It's a buffalo mozzarella.
So even in this period of great uncertainty, firms want to now make investments in order to diversify their risks.
Yeah.
But they need financing that simply isn't available from the commercial banks.
Now, the other thing which I found very, very interesting is your involvement with Irish Ferries.
Yes, yes. So recently we've signed loan contracts with Irish Ferries for, I think it was a total of 135 million for two new vessels. the William Butler Yeats that just arrived just before Christmas and launched his first service there about 2 weeks ago. And a new vessel that's arriving next year that's going to be the largest ferry in the world. And obviously this is part of their business plan, their normal operations to increase capacity. But I suppose there is a Brexit dimension in that it certainly provides Ireland with increased direct ferry capacity into continental markets if needed.
Yes, it's envisaged initially just on the Holyhead run, but if needs be, it can head for France.
Yeah, I think it'll do the Holyhead run on the winter schedule, and then on the summer schedule they'll shift it to France. And,
yeah.
But certainly that increases Ireland's connectivity, if you like, to continental Europe. We've also financed the expansion of the port of Cork for similar reasons. So they're obviously moving the port end to Ring of Skiddy in Cork. And together with the Irish Strategic Investment Fund, we finance the expansion of that. And that's the creation of a deep water port in Cork that, again, will provide direct access to continental European ports, to Rotterdam in particular, but also to have for Ireland in the event that it's needed in order to bypass UK
preparing
markets.
For war, isn't
drive
it?
Around sorry, Harry.
Yeah, just what's the total loan, the value of the loan book to Ireland at the moment? And is it at the maximum it could be? And I presume that it's much higher than it was than it was when you were in government, Andrew, and perhaps Ireland's credit rating wasn't quite so buoyant as it is now. And I noticed that you've also advanced or in the process of advancing a substantial loan as well to the National Children's Hospital, to that project. There's no concerns about that in the offing, is there?
Well, business is definitely picking up in Ireland, and I think obviously we're putting a special effort into Ireland for the reasons I've mentioned, the recognition that Ireland is particularly exposed to Brexit. We established an office here for the first time in Dublin 2 years ago, headed by Cormac Murphy, and that's definitely helped in terms of originating new deals in Ireland. So there's no limit on what we can do in Ireland. So we signed about $1 billion last year of deals in Ireland. That's definitely up quite significantly.
Did you fund the Children's Hospital?
We've loaned $490 million to the government for the Children's Hospital.
That was the total cost originally.
No, we never financed the entire cost of the hospital.
Joking.
So.
Well, it was at the very outset.
Yeah. I know, yeah.
Yeah, but he's saying it must have been higher already at that point because they would not finance
100%. When you lent them the 490,
that was only last year.
Yeah. What's that?
Yeah. So it was 983 million.
We only ever financed up to 50% of a project. So
let's get this straight. When you lent the 490 million, you were told that was 50% of the cost of the hospital.
Including some of the IT costs.
Well, that's quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, that shows that it was already known. Yeah.
Including some of the IT. So the IT was always on top of the original construction cost. So when you add that in, it was the total eligible investment costs for us were approaching $1 billion by the time
we signed
the loan.
What was the date of that loan?
We signed the loan in December 2018. Just over a year ago. 14 months ago. 2017.
So that means that $1 billion cost was known at Christmas 2017.
That's the point I was making.
Well, when you include the IT costs,
I think the figure in November 2017 was 983 million.
Yeah,
so it would have been roughly about half of that when you add in the IT costs.
So if the cost of the hospital goes up, can you lend them more money? Because you're saying your maximum is 50%. So for an example, if we told you it was 4 billion for the hospital, would you lend us 2 billion?
I mean, there's no application for additional financing for the National Children's Hospital. I think
hypothetically,
we'll consider any application. I mean, I don't see it as being a realistic prospect that the Irish government is going to ask us for an additional finance for this particular project.
You don't.
No, I don't think so, because it's already, it's already been financed through additional contributions from the Exchequer. So I don't think that is part of the funding plan. I should say.
And have they drawn down that money?
They have drawn down some of it, yes, and over the course of 2018. But I should say, we finance hundreds of infrastructure projects.
Yeah.
Every year across Europe. It's not unusual, obviously, that we would see cost overruns and indeed, delays in major infrastructure projects. And hospitals in particular, I should say, are complex projects to deliver.
I was listening to somebody who did it, who said it's not rocket science.
I can tell you from our experience, and we must have financed dozens of hospitals across Europe. Some of them have come in on time and on budget, but many have not. and they are always highly political projects in terms of in terms of delivery and the final specifications. So, you know, we'll continue to monitor, obviously, the project as we do with every infrastructure project, but we've no particular concerns. Our loan is to the Irish government, so we've no particular, obviously, credit concerns on this particular loan.
Arsila, did you want to come in on those loans to cushion the way?
Yeah, I think they will be extremely important because I think the exposure of Ireland to Britain, you know, the way we are the only country in the EU with double digits exports to Great Britain and double digits imports from Britain. I just saw a list yesterday, so there's we are extremely exposed, and I think it will.
Are your clients concerned, is what I'm really saying?
My clients? My clients are concerned to a certain extent, but you see, my practice is very international. So a lot of my clients are already German, Austrian, they might be Swiss, French, Polish, US clients. Okay, so they are a very international crowd. But yes, of course, some, let's say, have already started projects because of Brexit. I have a client who has moved its warehouse from the north and is now building one in North County Dublin, or has nearly finished building one for a large multinational drugs company so that they can stay within the EU after Brexit. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of extra, I would think, a lot of extra work. But yes, smaller companies, they're very worried. Of course, if they are for the moment exporting most of their ware, what they produce, into the UK market, it's a big headache for them, a massive headache. And the biggest headache for the moment is companies like to plan. So they like to know today, let's say, they have a 24-month cycle.
Yeah.
And for the moment, nobody can plan for the next 24 months because, as we heard today, Theresa May is still in battle. The others think the war is over. So you see, there's absolutely no certainty what's going to happen. And companies, it's serious for companies. It's a serious headache. If they now have to order how much they need of something for in 24 months, they haven't a clue.
Right.
They don't know. They cannot plan. And that's a big criticism of all companies. And that's small, medium and large size companies.
Okay.
This complete uncertainty and ongoing uncertainty for long and long and long. It's a big problem and it's costly. It's costly for them.
OK. The other uncertainty, which is kind of not directly related to what you're doing, but presumably will impact. You referred to Dan O'Brien's article in the, I think it's in the Sindo today. And he was referring to the OECD thing that was published yesterday, I do believe. We've had our battles with Europe about our tax rates, and every minister for finance has held the line. But the you can feel a tsunami building up. But now the OECD.
Yeah, Dan O'Brien's point is really that the Americans seem to be changing their tune about how they're going to go about taxing multinationals. As we can see, there's a huge blowback against multinationals, you know, in any way, particularly Facebook. So what the OECD is looking at is a sales tax, meaning where the products are sold, that needs to be taxed. So, you know, that would absolutely decimate the way we do our tax situation here. And there seems to be...
Explain how that would decimate us.
Well, for an example, you know, Google that I alluded to earlier, you know, Google washes all its money from Europe and says it's sold out of Ireland, you know, well, Bermuda, really, but it's a company incorporated in Ireland. So they would then have to go to each country and say, look, well, we're selling X amount of sales here in the UK, in France, and we'd pay the tax there.
Isn't that what Europe wants them to do?
That was the basis of the Apple judgment, was it not?
It was the basis of what Europe wanted to do also, but there was such backlash. I mean, we were totally against it. Ireland was totally against it, but there's other countries against it also, so it's been slowed up. But what Dan O'Brien's article is saying now, the Americans seem to be getting on board with this now, so if they get on board with it, then this thing is actually going to happen. So he was saying, well, you shouldn't be fearful of the EU because they're so slow at doing these things. We were able to block it, but you won't be able to block this if it's coming towards from America. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, I've been on this show before arguing about the Apple tax. You know, I think that judgment was so clear and unequivocal that that money is ours. It's laughable that every single political party came out in this country and said, no, we don't want the money, it's not ours. You know, this ludicrous thing, the Minister for Finance at the time said, do you look at your Apple phone and see if it says made in Ireland? You know, how ridiculously stupid is that comment? That money...
Well, I can't remember which minister you're talking about, but you're not called them stupid.
Well, sorry, misleading, should I say, then. Misleading was... Well, it was basically saying because the phone hasn't gone made in Ireland on the bank. That money was washed through a stateless company that was incorporated in Ireland with no employees, and the EU then judged that the 13 billion should go to Ireland. It was very, very clear. But my point is, why every politician argued that it's no way it's our money is quite interesting.
What's your view on that, Bertie Ahern?
Well, you know, the original, the taxing has been going on for 30 years and the argument was going on. I was involved in moving it, the 10% rate up to 12.5% and doing away with the higher corporation tax so that we could maintain the 12.5%. But I don't think anyone would argue. I mean, the huge announcements we've even got since the start of this year, and we're only in the beginning of February, have been massive. And it's not only because of the tax, but it's been hugely important. And I think the argument and the fear always is that if we give in anywhere, we could be rolled over on this issue. And I mean, I remember, you know, when it's 25, 26 years ago, when I was Minister of Finance, the French were always on my back. Every single ECOFIN Council meeting, they found some way. There was a socialist, I can't remember his name offhand, but it was a socialist leader, and they were forever on about Ireland, Ireland, Ireland. And why were they doing it? Because they were watching even at that stage that we were building up the pharmaceutical, the chemicals, the medical supplies industry. And while there is a real risk, I don't disagree with you, there's a real risk that too few of the companies that make up the Irish economy are given all the corporation tax. But at the same time, a huge amount of our quality employment and our really good investments is because we have the tax.
But so can I just clarify one thing? Yes. I'm totally in favour of everything you said there, the 12.5% tax rate. Our problem is, for an example, the double Irish Dutch sandwich. Yes, yeah. Now, that was announced to the Irish people that we got rid of it in 2014. The numbers that I've just shown you in Google show they're still using it. So they're still using...
Wasn't that to end in 2020?
It's supposedly to end in 2020. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, so these corporations are not paying 12.5%. I think most Irish people would say we need to stick to the 12.5% rule, and it's working very well.
I just finished one point, Mary. I think where we're vulnerable, and we're always vulnerable, if the multinationals wash things through the Irish economy, if we're on safe ground, I think, when... our figures show what's made in Ireland, what's made on the island of Ireland. I think what happens is if the stuff is made in Russia or China and it's been washed through our figures, that's where the weakness is. And I think that's where we have to be very, very careful, that our multinational companies, that the production is in Ireland, because otherwise people are going to say that this is a tax haven, and that's the difference.
Can I make one point, just maybe, that we've all now talked about goods manufacturing, and this is actually not what this article is about.
Services.
Okay?
Yeah,
it's about digital services. So there's a massive difference there. And yes, the corporation tax rate, 12.5%, and this whole corporation tax, that's also a problematic area in some ways. And as you know, there last March, 2018, the EU came out with new proposals because they want to change the corporation tax, how that's done, but all over Europe. And for example, for the digital services, they want to create something what's called a digital PE, a digital permanent establishment, which we don't have in the rules yet. So that's where that's coming from. But the OECD, what they now want to do, it's all about digital services. Okay,
right.
So it's nothing to do with made somewhere. It's more about, let's say, somebody in Germany or France or Spain taking a website, looking at a website and then clicking on it and taking a service from there, you know, downloading a song or downloading some sort of service. And that's there. A big discussion is ongoing now. Where are those things going to be taxed? Are they taxed where they're provided from maybe, let's say, a corporation based in Ireland or in Luxembourg or the Netherlands? Or is it taxed where the person sits who has just clicked and consumed the piece of music or something and taken the piece? And there, obviously, economy. We are an economy here in Ireland with not a lot of consumers. So if it's getting taxed in the future, it's more where the consumers sit. Obviously, we will lose out more because we have less consumers.
I was just going to say a lot of these companies are incorporated in Ireland but not domiciled in Ireland. So they all have Irish names, for an example. Mm. Like Google's is... Google Ireland Holdings, you know, that's actually domiciled in Bermuda. So, you know, they are incorporated companies in Ireland, but they're not domiciled here.
But I see a big building down there and clatters of staff.
Well, we had this argument before because when I was arguing about the Apple tax, everybody screamed down at me saying, look, what about the Apple employees? You know, we need the jobs. The company that owes us the 13 billion and has paid over the 13 billion has no employees in Ireland, has no employees at all in the world. Mm. So you can't argue both ways about there's a lot of employee. Apple is saying that it's two different companies, so we should treat them as two different companies and they should pay us the rightful tax.
Yeah, it's kind of, that's kind of the moral leverage argument. I mean, and the difficulty is, and it happens in France as much as it happens in Ireland, is the headline rate for corporation tax bears no relation to the actual amount of tax that's paid. Mm-hmm. It's a big problem. I read a very interesting article by John Lanchester, the novelist and commentator in the Sunday Times a couple of weeks ago, and he said there are three solutions to all of this. First one is to get rid of all the tax havens in the world. We said, which isn't as difficult as people think. Number two, get rid of trusts. And number three, introduce a system of transparency. That's the most difficult part of the equation. Yeah, well, but if all three of those things were done, that difficulty would be avoided.
We've been talking about transparency now, you know, for a long time. You wanted to come in, Andrew.
Well, I mean, I think all these debates about corporate taxation is a reminder to Ireland of its traditional dependence on foreign direct investment as a driver of jobs, economic growth and innovation, and the need to continue to strengthen innovation, domestic innovation and enterprise, indigenous enterprise, as a source of future economic growth. The good thing for Ireland is actually, from an EIB perspective, we're seeing lots of middle-sized Irish companies now growing very quickly, innovation-led, research-led, filing a lot of patents, who are looking for growth capital from places like the European Investment Bank to become much larger companies. This isn't something we've seen a lot in Ireland in the past. And that's something we really have to foster. I always remember the Americans in the 1960s, late 50s and 60s, built the National Science Foundation because the Russians got to space first. So they said, we have to build a science infrastructure or else we'll all be speaking Russian in 20 years. That was the mentality. Ireland needs to build a national science and research infrastructure because of our vulnerability on tax. We need to change the basis of the competitive advantage of the country to something that's very sustainable in the long run. That needs to be financed, and that's, again, something the European Investment Bank is happy to support.
I would totally agree with that.
Yeah, well, if you take the role of the IDA and the role of Enterprise Ireland, there is such an organisation, isn't there, for science?
Oh, absolutely. Science Foundation Ireland. It was, I think, one of the most, one of the best things Ireland did in the 1990s was the decision to establish the Science Foundation Ireland. I think it's proved a huge success. But, like, as with everything, it competes for resources. But we need to remind ourselves that without that investment in research, in skills, in innovation, we're going to continue to be very heavily dependent on foreign direct investment.
But we do have that in a certain extent. We have the research and development tax credit. We have, you know, the way tax incentives for companies to do the research and development of new technologies in Ireland. So we have that for a long, long time. So I do think Ireland has all that to a certain extent, but I fully agree that it's brilliant that we are going to get more funding, because I think Ireland will need a lot of funding now, because we are so much more exposed to Brexit than any other country in Europe, that I think if that's not totally recognised, also just in monetary terms, it's not just about keeping a hard border off our island, but it's also to really give us sort of the help so that we can deliver on products, on new projects, so that we suffer hopefully as little as possible.
Harry?
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with all that. I think FDI has given Ireland a bonanza or a boost over the years that probably isn't in proportion to the performance of our economy. And you have this kind of disparity that's emerged between GDP and the actual amount of product that's produced. And to some, it's been a problem. We seem to have coasted it, certainly since we've recovered in 2011. But I mean, I think what Andrew and Paul and Ursula were saying is completely true. We need to be able to innovate ourselves. And one of the things I was just thinking about there is the Young Scientists of the Year Award. And we've got such amazing scientists that have emerged.
Positively
embarrassing. Over the last 30 or 40 years. And I sometimes wonder, do we have an adequate follow-on from that, to see that we have this amazing thing at the end of second level, but are we continuing that into third level and beyond in terms of innovating and coming up with fresh and original ideas?
Emily, your take on all of this?
I suppose it's a view into a world I don't know much about. I would definitely think that European Investment Bank investment into medical research would be, I mean, does much of it go on at the moment?
Oh, it's one of the areas, obviously, that's supported heavily by Science Foundation Ireland. But actually, we're finding a very, very successful medtech cluster in Ireland, particularly in the west of Ireland, around Galway.
Yes. Oh, yeah, it's
and
huge.
We've got a very strong pipeline of companies coming to us looking for, you know, growth capital deals of, you know, 10 to 30 to 40 million.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a really, there's kind of five hotspots around Europe for these type of technologies, for medical technologies, and Ireland is one of them.
Yeah, because
so
I definitely think we'd have the medical expertise to keep researchers at home and build a really strong medical research economy.
Yeah.
Okay, before we wrap it up here, as I was saying, sounds like preparations for war. If they're going to evacuate the Queen and we're going to go around England and all of that. But we're getting a connector, an interconnector with France.
Well, that's certainly one of the projects we're very interested in for a number of reasons. Airgrid are in relatively late stages in planning the first direct power connection between Ireland and continental Europe, which...
Because of Brexit, it is.
Well, I think it's for a number of reasons. I think it's probably taken on a new urgency, obviously, because of Brexit. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think there's any overnight risk, you know, on the 1st of April to our power supplies in this country, but certainly as a longer-term measure... Clearly, this has taken on a new urgency, and the French are also interested. The idea would be to connect the south of Ireland with Brittany. The Commission are very interested in supporting the project with some European grant aid, and we'd be very interested in providing cheap, long-term debt to support the project. I mean, I think it's got to go through a few stages in terms of regulatory approval, government approval, and so on. But I think it's a fascinating project for a number of reasons. One is obviously security of supply for Ireland in the current context is clear. But also when you look at what's happening in Europe, I mean, the French are have effectively decided to turn off nuclear in the next 15 years. The Germans have already made that decision and have now decided they're turning off coal by 2038.
Yes. Which
is providing 40% of German power at the moment. There's going to be a huge need for new power supplies, renewable power supplies into continental European markets. Ireland has a golden opportunity on the East Coast, along the Irish Sea, to export power into continental markets. And this is obviously how this could be done. So great project for a number of reasons and something I think that we should try and accelerate.
Right. Interesting, because when you hear people talking about Europe, I mean, a lot of Irish people go to France on their holidays and love France and all that. Mm-hmm. But at a political level, Macron is snapping at us about the tax. And you said they were on your back and all of that before. Will Britain be an enormous loss to us in those negotiations? You know,
they will, and I think there's no doubt about that. One of the great things of the last 40 years, I suppose, is the relation that was built up in the political system, but not only within the civil service, within state agencies, that the Irish and the British, by and large, were on the same page on most issues. When it came to agriculture, we moved to the French, so we weren't all against the French. So, but that relationship goals whenever they pull out, and you know, let's see what Theresa May. We were talking earlier on about what Theresa May said in the Telegraph this morning, Harry. But you know, she said a totally different thing last Sunday. So I wouldn't be, you know, last Sunday she said that, or two Sundays ago she said that the withdrawal agreement was the only agreement that she spent 2 years on, it couldn't change. She wouldn't do it. So she'd probably say something else again on Tuesday week.
I'm almost tempted to say Atni and Kirog Kirogala.
She will switch ground very quick.
Okay, listen, we will leave it there for the moment. Andrew McDowell, thank you very, very much indeed for coming in.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. Welcome back to the programme, and we're going to move on to something completely different now. But before we do, a couple of listeners were on to know, Bertie Ahern, would you budge on the backstop now?
No, I wouldn't budge on the backstop now, but I do think, as I've said all along, there will be pressure, maybe not public pressure, but I think there will be pressure at some stage to try to assist in some way to get over the logjam. And we have to be ready to do that. And what I said earlier on was, I think what Simon McCoveney's opening position on that was, that he won't do it in the withdrawal agreement, but in the future relationship, he accepts, I think, the point that if it can't be permanent, so you need to find and get a better way of doing it. And also, I think we need to be looking at that. But as far as changing the withdrawal agreement or amending the withdrawal agreement now, the Irish government should sit in its hands and wait to see what happened. And there's one other point I think is important. I was listening to the Shadow Chancellor yesterday, McDonald, and it looks as if the talks that went on between Corbyn and May last week were relatively amicable talks, and they, I think, are pushing the customs union. So I wouldn't bet against the customs union will come back into the agreement. And if that happens, it's fine. So, but we should sit and be ready for that. But at this stage, we don't have to do anything.
Okay. And thank you for that. Now, this is going down memory lane. A London rooftop, 1969, cold January day, tiny crowd of people gathered to see none other than the Beatles giving what would turn out to be their last ever public performance. That was 50 years ago, folks. They're still making news with another documentary coming up about them. Now I'm joined by the broadcaster, Simon Marr, to take a look at the legacy. That was to be the Beatles' last ever performance. Do they know that?
There was talk at the time. There's the original Let It Be documentary that was made around about the time Paul McCartney was angling for them to go back on the road again. They hadn't been able to tour for a long time because they couldn't even hear themselves. But around about that sort of 68, 69, McCartney in particular was saying, I really want to do it. Ringo was kind of apathetic about it. Lennon really wasn't interested. But they wanted to do this. And they wanted to try some of this material. There was talk of a TV special. There was talk of a film. So they said, right, let's do something. So over the space of a couple of days, they really organised this. They brought in Billy Preston and they said, right, let's go on the roof.
Right. Extraordinary. And what was the outcome of it, if you know what I mean?
Well, Kevin, they did 42 minutes on the roof. So they went up, they borrowed a couple of coats because it was, as you mentioned, it was freezing cold, and they said, let's see what we can get away with. Let's see how many songs we can get in this. So they got to record 5 full songs, did a couple of takes on other ones, they recorded the audio, they recorded some of the film, and then eventually the Metropolitan Police came along and said, lads, can you turn it down a bit? So they just went on until the police got to the top of the stairs, you know, and then cut it off, and that was the end.
And do we know what was recorded then?
There was a number of songs that were recorded, a number of tracks that they were talking about that they wanted to include, that were going to be included, and they decided, well, look, let's try and bank some. So what they decided to do was that they had stuff like Don't Bring Me Down is probably one of the most famous, or Don't Let Me Down, it's probably one of the most famous, and it's a video, I think there's 3 or 4 billion views of it on YouTube since it's been made. It was probably one of the main features. The end of the original Let It Be documentary was kind of the 20-minute set of it. So it was some of those songs that they were playing at the time,
right?
You know, but you could see, and you could see what's very interesting about it is you could see straight away they were enjoying it, like despite the cold and despite the fact that they're on top of a roof. You know, they looked like they were really getting into this.
And the title track of that was Let It Be.
Yes.
Okay, let's have a listen.
I wake up to the sound of music. Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom. Let it be.
But it's funny that their songs are still terribly familiar to people. You say that from the very first single, it was clear they were going to.
There was something about it because you can imagine there were so many bands that were going around at the time, and people thought this is going to be the next huge band. And I think just before the Beatles, you had bands like Jerry and the Pacemakers. And
yeah.
I think Jerry and the Pacemakers had 3 consecutive number ones. But as soon as the Beatles got signed and they met Brian Epstein and they went and there was the infamous, did they get signed? They wanted to get signed by Decca. They didn't. But then once they were signed, they went straight into studio and they recorded Love Me Do. You know, and again, these are really simple 3-minute pop songs, and it kind of got to, I think it was number 18, 17 or 18 in the charts, and people thought, okay, this band have a chance. But then they went and they recorded the first album, and when they recorded the first album, it went straight to number one. But really it was Love Me Do that launched them.
Okay. Tell the listeners what you just told us in here.
So Love Me Too was recorded in 62, and when it was recorded, it's 43 years since the end of the First World War, and it's now 57 years since it was released. So closer to the First World War than it was to now. It's frightening. But what's amazing is that it's still there, you know, and while there are songs from 5 years ago that have dated, there's entire genres have dated, people will still come back to Love Me Do every time.
You'd say in terms of America that the Ed Sullivan Show was important.
Yeah, it was huge. It was.
Yeah, it was for a variety of people, wasn't it?
It was. No, it really.
The Clancy Brothers made it through the Ed Sullivan Show. I mean, you don't put the Clancy Brothers in the same place as the Beatles, sure you don't.
But it's the exposure that you got. The exposure, like you went on the Ed Sullivan Show, and he had a chance not to just perform one or two songs. I think the Beatles performed 4 or 5 songs on the day, and that was huge for them. And the fact that I think it was 63 million people watched the Beatles perform that night. And they really broke down walls, because a lot of bands had gone to America, a lot of UK bands had gone to America and hadn't ever been able to make that breakthrough.
Yeah.
But when the Beatles got there and broke through, suddenly it changed. And
was that the publicity beforehand?
I think it was part of it, but there was just obviously just something about them. You know, whether it was the personalities of the four, that they were maybe a little bit different to the smiley jumper wearing pop stars from before, that they were a little bit bold. And I think people in that sort of very early 1960s time, people were looking for something that was a bit bold.
Right. Okay. I suppose people still are. Anyway, one of the tracks they performed on the Ed Sullivan Show is I Want to Hold Your Hand.
It's such a feeling that my love, something I think you'll understand. When I say that something, I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand.
They all sound kind of very simple and nice, don't they? They don't sound like seriously dangerous rock stars, do they?
I think they're probably, as confidence grew, and particularly for a band like the Beatles, as confidence grew, they were willing to be a little bit more anti-establishment and willing to push that a bit more. Because when you see the bands, like you see the Rolling Stones then, you know, who went in, and then you saw...
Totally different.
That's the thing, but the barrier was down then at that stage, and I think that's what made a big difference for the Beatles. And as the Beatles became more confident, they started to change what they sung about. It wasn't just Love Me Do or I Want to Hold Your Hand. They moved on themselves.
And what would you pick out to illustrate that?
Well, when you look at everything, like, you know, from the, let's call it the experiences that they may have had, so stuff like Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, or you talk about, you know, I'm keeping it polite, but Revolution, really anything off Sgt. Pepper's, like, you know, they started to move on themselves.
Yeah.
You know, and that was a very big deal, because I think bands, a lot of bands at the time, probably still now, thought that if you do a thing, that's your thing. And you don't really move on from it. You may survive 5, 6, 7 albums, but you don't really change the core of what you do. Whereas the Beatles were willing and probably were in that lucky position where they could change what they were on a semi-regular basis.
Timing as well with the mood.
timing was great. Timing for the Beatles was great. They managed to get into the US in particular. But just like when you even think in the UK, there was that post-war generation. So you had that sort of swing in 60s, you know, and then you had to say the British invasion in the mid-60s, you know, in America as well. So these were big changes and big cultural changes as much as big musical changes. And they were there right at the right minute.
Right. Probably unaware of it.
Probably, yeah. Yeah,
I'm going to jump to their last movie.
Yeah, well, so that's the thing. They had done a couple of different movies. So they'd done A Hard Day's Night, they had done Help, and then when they're getting towards the end of the career, they were working on Let It Be, which would be sort of more of a documentary feature. And it was there that the reason they were doing that was to document the sessions that were involved in Let It Be as an album. And it was very, rather than it being a film, the first two films, Hard Day's Night was a caper about a trip from Liverpool to London and Paul's granddad and everything was in it. Whereas when it got to Let It Be, this is very much documentary about how they made the album. And things, in some ways, were a bit bleak because it was a very real documentary of where the Beatles were. They'd really been cosseted in a studio for 3 or 4 years at that stage. They didn't have that external exposure, so they didn't look quite as happy as perhaps they had been before.
OK. Last clip.
You know I work all day to get your money to buy a thing, and it's worth it just to hear you say you're gonna give me everything. So why on earth should I moan? 'Cause when I get you alone, you know I feel okay. When I'm home, everything seems to be right. When I'm home, feeling you holding me tight, tight, yeah. It's been a hard
day. And just briefly then, the breakup.
Yeah. The breakup is always one of the most interesting bits about any band. But in the Beatles, it was probably cabin fever they had at that stage. They all wanted to go off and do their separate things, but particularly Lennon and McCartney, you know, and they had quite a serious falling out. And luckily, fortunately, they made up as they went on later on in the 70s. Ringo stayed friends with everybody. George went away and did his own thing and was very well regarded as a musician. And there was always a talk then right through the 70s, would they get back together? Was there going to be the reunion tour? But probably for the better, there never was.
Right. OK. You've experience of these bands flying around the world as well and breaking up and getting back together again.
Yeah. Off again they are this year.
So I gather. OK. Listen, we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
And that's it from us for today. I'd like to thank everybody who contributed to the programme. And I would like to say, looking at my credits here, the programme was produced by Annette Egan. Bridget Nichols, nearly called her Mac Nichols again, sorry about that. Bridget is our broadcast coordinator. Rachel Breslin and Lisa McGough are our researchers. Kieran Dunn was on sound, and the series producer is Margaret Carley. Back with you the same time next week, Saturday and Sunday. Until then, from all of us, a very good day to you.